What aspects of the 2016 U.S. presidential election have been under-investigated by mainstream press in 2017? Has the media downplayed the use of chemical weapons in America's prisons? Is indigenous use of the rights of nature being used successfully to prevent fracking and other destructive resource practices? Why would the economically robust Canadian province of Saskatchewan be witnessing declines in social indicators, and why hasn't mainstream media gotten to the bottom of it? What institutional factors contribute to the underreporting of relevant stories in Canada and beyond? As we begin a new year of broadcasts, the Global Research News Hour once again looks at the year past to examine some of the most important news stories that got little or no attention in the major media. We'll hear from Andy Lee Roth, Associate Director of Project Censored. We'll hear from John Chertow, Editor-in-Chief of Intercontinental Cry. And we'll hear from Patricia Elliott, Associate Professor with the University of Regina's School of Journalism. On this week's program, 2017 Year in Review, the most censored international, Indigenous, and Canadian stories. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of January 5th, 2018. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabe territory and the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Neither Channel 10 nor the White House gave away details of the plans and scenarios that the U.S. and Israel might pursue against Iran and Hezbollah. But it is obvious that one of these scenarios is to try to destabilize Iran from within by engineering disturbances or protests and activating a number of armed separatist groups. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, one of the Trump administration's closest Middle East allies, said as much openly in a TV interview some months ago. He warned his country was going to, quote, take the war inside Iran, unquote, as a preemptive measure, meaning before Iran tries to take the war into Saudi Arabia. It would not be surprising if the demonstrations held on Friday in several Iranian towns in protest at inflation were in some part a product of that strategy. That comes from the article, The U.S. and Israel's New Secret Anti-Iran Plans, by Abdel Bari Atwan, post-January 2nd, originally appearing at Rayal Yum. Lethally shooting around 20 Iranians through New Year's Day, including at least one policeman, suggests foreign interference. What's going on resembles March 2011 protests in Daraa, Syria. U.S.-supported armed protesters fired on police, instigating conflict. Security forces responded to violent armed insurgents, killing civilians and police, attacking government offices. What began in Daraa spread elsewhere in Syria, things escalating into Obama's war, unresolved nearly 7 years later. That comes from the article, Foreign Intervention Behind Iran Protests, CIA Instigated Street Violence, by Stephen Lendman, posted January 2nd. While many of the demands are legitimate, all signs are pointing toward Western treachery in an attempt to break Iran in the final domino to fall in the Middle East before an even bigger confrontation is ignited. Destroying Iran would also destroy Hezbollah, weaken Syria and Russia, and threaten Israel. Whether or not it will succeed will depend on the level of subversion that has been possible by the United States intelligence apparatus since 2009 and the ability of Iran to squash the revolt. If anything can be learned from the 2009 revolution, Iran will move quickly and will smash the protests with an iron fist. However, if the protests taking place in Iran today are indeed a color revolution, and if the West is committed, the path to Persia will likely see an escalation in activity, violence, and ultimately directly military confrontation by proxy and even by the U.S. military itself. That comes from the article, What is Happening in Iran? Is Another Color Revolution Underway? By Brandon Turbeville, posted December 31st, originally appearing at Activist Post. A senior U.S. official said that after 2 days of talks, the U.S. and Israel reached at a joint document which articulates full cooperation to deal with Iran's nuclear drive, its missile programs, and its other threatening activity in the region. The U.S. official said the document's goals was to translate President Trump's Iran speech to joint U.S.-Israeli strategic goals regarding Iran and to set up a joint work plan. At what the TV report described as a secret meeting at the White House, the U.S. and Israel specifically agreed to set up joint teams to handle various aspects of the Iranian threat. This includes a joint team, the report said, which will deal with Iranian activity in Syria and Tehran's support for the Hezbollah terror organization. This working group will also deal with drafting U.S.-Israeli policy regarding the day after in the Syrian civil war. That comes from the article, U.S. and Israel Sign Secret Plan to Take on Iran, Report, by Ali Najad, posted December 31st, originally appearing at The Iranian. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Here to guide us through some of the underemphasized and downright suppressed stories of 2017 is Andy Lee Roth. He is the Associate Director of Project Censored. Project Censored is the 41-year-old media research program based out of Sonoma State University in California, which now connects with hundreds of faculty and students at colleges across the U.S. and around the world. How are you doing, Andy?
I'm just fine, Michael. So good to be on the show with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you. So, most censored stories of 2016, 2017, are there any big themes in this year's release that maybe you'd like to, something that stands out?
Well, you know, I think one of the theme of our book this year is the idea of press freedoms in a so-called, quote, post-truth world. And so I think a lot of these stories this year focus in one way or another on this idea of are we all committed to the idea of an objective world with facts that are shared in common? And so that theme runs throughout the book and can certainly be found in a few of the top 25 stories, including one that just continues to stun me, a story that was originally broken by reporters at the Bureau of Investigative Journalism in London, where Crofton Black and Abigail Fielding Smith reported on how over at least a five-year period, the Pentagon paid a British PR firm, the British PR firm Bell Pottinger, more than $660 million to run a top-secret propaganda program in Iraq. That involved the production, among other things, of fake al-Qaeda videos. Mm-hmm. So this story, just amazing, you know, over the past year when we've had pundits and politicians of all political stripes, as well as the establishment press crowing over fake news, the U.S. media completely ignored the story of how one of the most powerful U.S. government institutions, the Department of Defense, secretly use taxpayer money to create fake news of its own. So, you know, and the book is full of this year's top 25 list is full of, I think, equally stunning stories where you go, I can't believe that happened. And then on top of it, I can't believe that happened. And the corporate media, the so-called mainstream media, didn't deem it newsworthy.
Yeah, I think it's probably brought an extra currency to independent programs like this one, and of course to your organization, that we really have to double up. I mean, the level of deceit or omission of these important stories is so insidious.
Right. I mean, whether we have corporate news reporting on the statements of people like Kellyanne Conway, who in January of the year invoked alternative facts as the explanation for Sean Spicer's insistence that the Trump inauguration had the largest crowd ever, or just last month when Sarah Huckabee Sanders chastised the press. I think you're focusing on the wrong thing, she said, when they were asking about Trump retweeting these Islamophobic videos. And she said, whether it's a real video, the threat is real. So basically you had, Sarah Huckabee Sanders endorsing the idea of propaganda, the idea that fake information is okay as long as it pursues a real goal. So I think, yes, as much as ever, the importance of a truly free and robust independent press is just crucial as a counterbalance, as a bulwark against the kind of the notion of post-truth, alternative facts, fake news, and the like.
You just to drill down more, since Trump, for whatever reason, and the presidential election seems to be kind of a big case study or whatever. You just mentioned that big data and dark money behind the 2016 election. That's your number five story. The mention of the Cambridge Analytica, which is the affiliate of that larger British company, Strategic Communications Laboratories, and one of its the chief executive officer was quoted in the releases after Trump's victory as saying, quote, "We are thrilled that our revolutionary approach to data-driven communication has played such an integral part in President-elect Trump's extraordinary win," unquote. So that's interesting, and yet all we seem to hear about when it comes to fraud in the election is, oh, the Russians did it.
Right. And so, yes, it's super important to understand this broader picture, and that, as much as many of us here in the U.S. and around the world may be fixated on Donald Trump, again, the folks at Cambridge Analytica who use this data analytics company that uses micro-targeting as part of its election campaign consulting, what they said after the election is that, the candidate, referring to Trump, became the instrument for implementing a big data model. And this is big business. Cambridge Analytica earned an estimated $15 million overall during the 2016 campaign. And immediately after Trump's victory, the company's CEO was touring European conferences showcasing their success in the U.S. So they're literally capitalizing on that victory.
Maybe we could talk about a related story, and this has to do with the DNC, the Democratic National Convention, and the recognition of foul play in the choice of the Democratic candidate. This would be the number four story?
Number nine, on the DNC claiming the right to select the presidential candidate?
Yeah. Yes, that, nine, number nine, sorry.
Yeah. So this is another remarkable story that appeared, in a variety of places. Michael Flanato in The Observer, Ruby Kramer from BuzzFeed, Joshua Holland in The Nation reported on the results, basically, there was a class action lawsuit filed in June of 2016 on behalf of the supporters of Bernie Sanders against the DNC and its former chair, Debbie Wasserman Schultz. And the charges of the case were that the DNC had broke legally binding neutrality agreements in the primaries by basically positioning Hillary Clinton to be the nominee, to be the Democrats' nominee before a single primary vote was cast. And the news on this is not so much the lawsuit itself as what came out in the hearings for the lawsuit, where, among other things, the DNC attorney asserted that it would have been within the DNC's rights, and I'm going to quote here, to go into back rooms like they used to and smoke cigars and pick the candidate that way. The DNC attorney went on to say that's not the way it was done, but they could have, and that would have been their right. So what was at stake here was language from the DNC charter that requires the process to be impartial and even-handed. And what the DNC's attorneys in court were arguing was that a judge, the courts, could not determine what even-handed and impartial would count, what would amount to even-handed and impartial treatment in this case. Hmm. So it's quite a remarkable story. And there's additional evidence from some of the other reporting that I just mentioned. Ruby Kramer in BuzzFeed was looking at the released DNC emails and showing that the DNC and Clinton's campaign had begun merging operations, consolidating research communications and media monitoring, not simply before Sanders had dropped out of the race, but even while he still remained a viable candidate much sooner, in other words, than had been previously reported or publicly disclosed.
Yeah, it's a very, very suspicious omission. Maybe more cynical people might say mainstream media is kind of fronting for the higher ups in the Democratic Party on that one. That's a scoop, or it should be.
Yeah, and I think there's one more kind of footnote on this story that I think speaks to the idea of how politicized the news coverage of, first of all, there was not much news coverage of this particular angle, but then how politicized it is when there is. I mentioned the reporter Michael Senato, who reports for The Observer. Even his reporting, which consistently relied on official documents, including those leaked DNC emails and courtroom transcripts, as well as primary sources, when The Observer published his reports on this story, they were reported as opinion pieces rather than straight news reporting.
Mm-hmm.
So they're fact-based, but they're not treated as news because they challenge some of the most cherished, notions of how the parties select their candidates in the primary stage of the election. So this is, again, I think this fits in this kind of theme of a sort of a post-truth world. We have news that isn't based on facts, but is treated as if it were. And then when we have fact-based reporting, like Sinatra's reporting for The Observer, it's treated as opinion because it goes against the kind of dominant narrative.
Let's talk about a couple of the issues around the law enforcement and their kind of draconian measures that have been, because I think that's something that is also a common theme in a lot of censored your censored stories. So, like the number 22 story, militarization of law enforcement inside prisons. Number 19, use of chemical weapons inside of prisons. And number 11, the law enforcement surveillance of phone records in cooperation with AT&T collecting phone records. So, would you like to maybe address that chemical weapons one in particular really stands out. So,
yeah, this is again the power of independent reporting, the ability of reporters to connect the dots in ways that give us a deeper story. The key source on this, so this is from reports by Daniel Motar in The Nation and Sarah Lazer at Alternet. And they're reporting how chemical weapons, including several types of tear gas, are being used against prisoners in the United States, despite the fact that the International Chemical Weapons Convention of 1977 banned the use of these chemicals in warfare. But the background on this, the thing that makes Motar and Lazer's reporting possible is that since 2013, the War Resisters League has been documenting the use of tear gas in prisons. And so they've been getting letters from inmates describing the use of tear gas and pepper spray. But the other thing the War Resisters League has been doing is looking at who are the producers of the tear gases and pepper sprays that are used in these prison settings. And they document how companies, including Sabre, Combined Tactical Systems, Sage, Safariland, all sell tear gas to prisons in forms that are designed specifically for use in enclosed spaces. So on one hand, we have the idea that these chemical weapons are actually, their use violates international treaties about the uses of chemical weapons. And on the other hand, we have companies, many of them U.S.-based, that are looking for new markets and finding that prisons and jails are ideal settings for their wares.
Yeah, this is another one I wanted to get through. Number 14, judges across U.S. using racially biased software to assess defendants' risk of committing future crimes. So that seems to be really moving into spooky territory.
Yeah, this is great reporting from a group of investigative reporters at ProPublica, Julia Ongwin, Jeff Larson, Surya Matu, and Lauren Kirshner. If we go back in time, in 2014, Eric Holder was then the U.S. Attorney General, and he publicly warned that the use of so-called risk assessments might be injecting bias into the nation's judicial system. Very little happened about that, but in May of 2016, ProPublica published the results of an extensive study they had done looking at data from Broward County in Florida, where they found risk scores, where they got access to risk scores of more than 7,000 people who had been arrested in that county. And the risk scores in Broward County are used to determine which defendants are sufficiently low risk to be released on bail pending their trials. But in many other places across the U.S., these risk scores are used by judges also to determine the length of sentences. So anyway, the risk score is a significant thing. Here's what the ProPublica reporters found. They found that the risk scores produced by this algorithm proved to be, quote, remarkably unreliable in forecasting violent crime. Only 20% of the people predicted to commit violent crimes went on to do so. In fact, the algorithm was only somewhat more accurate than a random coin toss. And the formula was particularly likely to falsely flag black defendants as future criminals, wrongly labeling them this way almost twice as often as white and their white counterparts. The company that produces the software that is used in Broward County, the algorithm that the Broward County judges use, and it's widely used across the country, is a company called North Point. And the software is called COMPAS, which is an acronym, C-O-M-P-A-S. When ProPublica and others have attempted to get the kind of what are the criteria the algorithm used, North Point has argued that algorithm is a proprietary matter, and they will not publicly disclose the calculations that COMPAS uses to determine defendants' risk scores. So the ProPublica report can show massive disparities, but it's in effect a black box as to what about the algorithm is generating those disparities. Mm. And that raises serious questions about whether defendants can really have a fair chance to challenge the ways that the use of those algorithms impact them.
We're running a little low on time. I want you to maybe bring up one or two good news stories, because I find that you usually do have something that's good. I think there's one on an Indian resilience against in coping with climate change, and there's another one on a constitutional challenge for again on the around mitigating climate change.
Yes, I want to add one more to that mix. So I'll speak just quickly on the young plaintiffs invoking constitutional grounds for climate protection. This is the case Juliana versus the United States that will come to trial early in the next year, February 5th, 2018. And in this trial, which is being brought by, it was originally brought by plaintiffs ages 8 to 19, arguing that the federal government and the fossil fuel industry have knowingly endangered the plaintiffs by promoting the burning of fossil fuels, and that constitutes violations of their constitutional and public trust rights. And although this has been challenged several times, judges have consistently upheld the case, and it will go to court. And I think we should all keep February 5th on our calendars, because there are going to be amazing protests at courts all across the country on behalf of these plaintiffs, who are saying that the defendant, that whether or not what I'm trying to say here is that the defendants have so profoundly damaged the home planet that the plaintiff's fundamental constitutional rights to life and liberty are being threatened. And so this is a important case in terms of one of the first times that climate protection has been argued for on constitutional grounds. Mm-hmm. But the other story, if we have a little more time, the other story I would love to point people to is a good news story involving policing. It's our number 24 story on eight use of force policies that would prevent killings by the police.
Yes.
This story is the result of a study done last year by Campaign Zero, a police reform group that formed in the aftermath of the Ferguson protests. And as Jamila King reported in Mike, the study was the first wide-scale analysis to demonstrate the connection between differing use-of-force policies and the rate of police killings. So the Campaign Zero report identifies eight guidelines, things like requiring officers to de-escalate situations before resorting to force, restricting their use of chokeholds, prohibiting officers from shooting at moving vehicles, and requiring comprehensive reporting by officers when there are incidents involving police use of force. And what Campaign Zero found was that on average, looking at police departments across the country, I believe it's the 91 largest police departments in the country, they found that on average, each additional use of force policy that was implemented is associated with a 15% reduction in killings. So these use of force policies are excellent in terms of protecting civilians. But the part that really interests me about this story is that they also found that, you know, that despite resistance from police unions who claim that more restrictive use of force policies actually endanger officers, on the contrary, what Campaign Zero found, what their study shows, is that the numbers of officers assaulted or killed in the line of duty decreases in proportion with the number of regulations adopted by those departments. So these policies, this is why I think of this as a good news story, enhanced use of force policies protect not only civilians but also police officers in the line of duty.
I think we got maybe a little under a minute left to go, but I wanted to give you a chance to maybe highlight some of the features in Censored 2018, besides the top 25 most censored stories.
Thanks, Michael. Of course. Yes. Well, we have our usual chapter on junk food news and news abuse, which are focused on especially on election issues this year. The Media Democracy in Action chapter, we have great contributions by Rachel Jolly from the Index on Censorship, the new good folks at Tribeworthy, Kevin Gastola and Rania Kalik, Unauthorized Disclosure, their new podcast, and Ginny Gebhardt at Electronic Frontier Foundation. We've got a graphic chapter by Adam Bessie and Peter Glanting called Trump Universe that is really cool. Vicky and I have been working on that, getting a graphic chapter in the book for several years. And then we're super proud. The book closes out with chapters by Ralph Nader on breaking through power. And I believe we had this book has the last published piece by Edward S. Herman, who gave us a 30 years review of the Herman and Chomsky propaganda model. And we're so, we miss Ed Herman so much, but we're very pleased that we've got this piece that he wrote for us this past summer. So Andy, we think it's a pretty great book, and we hope people will have a look at it.
Andy Lee Scott, it's been a pleasure speaking to you again. Look forward to talking to you again in 2018.
Sounds great, Michael. Thank you.
Thank you. So we've been speaking with Andy Lee Roth. He is the Associate Director of Project Censored and is speaking to us from California.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. The online media platform Intercontinental Cry is a nonprofit newsroom producing public interest journalism centered on Indigenous peoples, climate change, and international human rights.
Joining us once again to discuss some of the most underreported stories of Indigenous peoples and Indigenous struggle over the past year is John Chertow. A member of the Mohawk Nation, John Chertow is editor-in-chief of Intercontinental Cry and founder of IC Magazine. He joined us from Winnipeg. John, let's get right into it. You brought to our attention a story about the Ponca Nation in Oklahoma and its efforts to combat fracking, which is causing earthquakes and poisoning the water that they depend upon for drinking and for their livestock. The story involves the invocation of something called the Rights of Nature as a legal device to prevent further destructive industrial activities. Can you give us some more details?
As many of our listeners already know, dozens of communities in the United States, as well as several countries, including New Zealand, India, Ecuador, Nepal, and Bolivia, have now passed laws that recognize the rights of nature. Surprisingly, however, we haven't seen any Indigenous nations adopt these important measures that offer us all additional means to legally protect the natural world. Well, on October 20th of 2017, the Ponca tribe of Oklahoma took the historic step of agreeing to add a statute to their constitution enacting the rights of nature. The decision to recognize the rights of nature came in response to the severe environmental harms that the Ponca have witnessed ever since the fracking industry began operating on their land. In 2017, there were at least 440 reported earthquakes in and around the Ponca Reservation, in a state that was essentially earthquake-free before the fracking industry moved into the area. What's more, as you pointed out, the water throughout the reserve has become too toxic to drink, bathe in, or even allow livestock to drink. Well, there's no telling how effective the rights of nature will be in resolving this, you know, ongoing severe environmental crisis. But with the incredible amount of momentum that the rights of nature gains in 2017, it will, in the very least, provide the Ponca with a new legal front and the international community to rally around.
Yes, that's the whole issue of the rights of nature. It seems like it's like a new legal mechanism, and it's interesting to see it being put into play, and curious to reflect on why these sorts of stories aren't getting more exposure. Speaking of the rights of nature, I wanted to maybe give you a chance to briefly remark about the a story about communities in the northwest region of Ecuador that invoked those rights for the first time since they were enshrined in the country's constitution. I mean, maybe a little bit of background on that battle and its significance.
Sure. Well, it was a very significant win, I think, even though the ruling that ultimately came down from the Ecuadorian court wasn't ideal. It was still an important win, ultimately, not only for the Afro-descendant community of Latacuita and the Awa community of Guadalito, but also for the overarching worldwide rights of nature movement. Well, the two communities approached the court just 2 years after Ecuador finally recognized the rights of nature in their own constitution, and they took two oil palm companies to court over the environmental harms that they have caused on their ancestral lands. And Judge Juan Francisco Gabriel Morales Suarez only partially accepted the community's claims, and ultimately he evaded a determination that the oil palm companies were guilty of causing any damage. But he nevertheless acknowledged that the two communities had rights, that they were, in effect, the guardians of the rights of nature within their lands. And, you know, he then shuffled around the responsibility to like a dozen or two different government departments, rather than pinpointing it and forcing the two palm oil companies into bankruptcy, basically to take responsibility for the damage that has been caused.
So essentially, it's a slap in the wrist.
Yeah. But it's still a good one, I guess. You know, because at least there was a slap. You know, and the two communities in partnership with various other organizations are still working to overturn the judgment and get a stronger ruling that is more indicative of the spirit and intent of the rights of nature.
Hmm. Your next story comes out of the Sierra Madre in Mexico. It was a land reclamation case stemming from a century-long conflict between the Huichol peoples and the Mestizo ranchers. Could you give us some more of the lowdown on that struggle and where it's headed?
Well, it's been going on, the struggle, since the early 1900s, when the Mexican state seized 10,500 hectares of the Huichol's ancestral land. Now, in September 2016, the Huichol finally headed down to this ancestral land in a process of reclamation. The Mexican court had ruled that the Huicholes could reclaim a 140-acre plot of farmland, which had since been occupied by Mestizo ranchers. Now, the ranchers themselves, claimed rights to the area based on decades of possession, as well as the existence of deeds and decrees issued by various governments, as well as their capacity to work the land. The Huicholes, despite that, still wanted to, reclaim this land that was wrongfully taken from them. So they physically did so with the backing of the court, but not exactly with the backing of the government or with police forces. And that is a significant point to make. Now, this whole situation is a powder keg. And I'm continually amazed that, we haven't seen any severe violence come out of this ongoing land reclamation. Because many of the ranchers in the area are openly racist towards the Huichol, and many of them have on several occasions tried to incite violence and pressure the government to send in the troops. In one case, the one landowner claimed to have proof that the Huichol were armed, even though they were not. Now, if Mexico had been operating under Chile's anti-terrorism law, for example, there would have been, severe violence. In another instance, a group of landowners took a group of Huicholes captive after they went to the local town to buy some food. And then, of course, there was the tragic assassination of Miguel Vasquez Torres, who was at the forefront of the legal fight to recover the these 10,500 acres. Miguel, who served as a guide to a team of IC reporters that were on site in 2016, was gunned down this past May alongside his brother, who was also actively involved in the restitution project. Now, the assassinations was a tremendous blow to the Huichol, but even so, it has to be said that calm and reason has largely prevailed. And that's likely why we've seen so little coverage of this struggle. The majority of the ranchers and the Huichol have been routinely urging the government to intervene. The government finally decided to do so in September of last year, after a group of ranchers set up a roadblock preventing the Huichol from reclaiming another small portion of land, again under court order. After that happened, the federal government agreed to set up a working group, one of the main objectives of which is to generate funding for the ranchers to, lower the risk of violence.
Wow, so that's something that could really start to erupt further in 2018, sounds like.
At any moment.
Uh-huh.
Literally. We will be watching the situation closely. We have reporters going down there regularly to keep us updated.
Perfect. This next story might be a little upsetting for those in left solidarity circles. You report on violence in the wake of the recent Nicaraguan municipal elections, which has the Sandinista government targeting Yatama, an indigenous-led political party. Four were left dead, dozens injured, and 50 being taken allegedly as political prisoners. What are the issues animating that dispute?
Well, that is a very complex question, one that goes back to like the 60s and, back to when the U.S. was at war with
the Contra War?
Yes.
Yeah.
And we can't really get into all the issues here, but essentially, for the past 30 years, the Indigenous Yatama Party has been slowly gaining political strength within the Caribbean coast of Nicaragua. And so during this recent municipal elections on November 5th, Yatima lost control of four municipalities. Now Yatima, as well as many as well as other opposition parties to the FSLN, protested what they denounced as yet another fraudulent election. According to the reports that we received, the Yatima alleged that more than 180 election anomalies. In one case, Yatima supporters were being flat-out turned away from polling stations. So the riot police and the military were flown in to crush the protests, and crush it they did. To correct an earlier point you made, at least seven people were killed.
Okay.
The initial reports were that four people were killed, and later reports it was seven. And then we had the dozens and dozens were injured, and others were arrested and jailed. And as if that wasn't bad enough, groups of FSLN supporters decided to go on a rampage, likely in response to the to Yatima's claims. They burned down the Yatima's Miskito language radio station, as well as their headquarters. The famous warrior Indian statue was destroyed, and Yatima's own flag was replaced by the flag of the Sandinista state. Now, when the dust began to settle, just a couple of days later, word came down that the Sandinista had ordered the capture or execution of Brooklyn Rivera, who was the political and spiritual leader of Yatima. We spoke to Rivera on November 10th, one day before he was scheduled to make a public appearance to celebrate Yatima's 30th anniversary. We had pointed out that he may be arrested, but he replied quickly that he simply has to celebrate with his people, regardless of the risk to his life. Unfortunately, that celebration, you know, took place without incident. Over 1,000 people attended the gathering. But the big question now for Yatima and the Miskito is, where do they go from here? Given the long and bitter history between Yatima and really all the Miskito people and the Nicaragua government, it's not clear where Yatima, which is a formidable political force, has to go, given that they have now lost basically all their political power. There's also the question of the colonos from other parts of Nicaragua who continue to stream into Miskito territory, claiming their land, and shooting up Miskito communities and houses. There's houses there that are just filled with bullets. Elders, children have been shot and killed, and the government has refused to intervene. How to resolve that situation as well? Without any political power there.
Yeah.
So it's a complex situation.
Yes, but certainly it's like the other ones you mentioned, very important and quite fascinating, and I think emblematic of the kind of journalism that Intercontinental Cry has been putting out for the last dozen years. Is there anything you could say in closing about how Intercontinental Cry itself has advanced over the past year? Are there any challenges or changes that maybe you'd like to mention?
Well, the challenges are the same as always. You know, we continue to struggle to find allies who can work with us in editing and writing and help us report on the frontline struggles that other newsrooms aren't covering. As well as finding allies in an organizational sense to help us build capacity and find ways to make IC financially sustainable, because there is really no funding available for Indigenous media in Canada or the United States. We have to rely on funding from individuals, and it's very hard to run a successful fully staffed newsroom from $5 donations. We still get by, but like IC is staffed essentially by one single person, and it's not enough given the sheer amount of ground that we have to cover, because we are a global news group. But we are continuing to find our way and find means to you know, stay afloat without compromising our vision or undermining the integrity of our work or undermining the nations that we represent and the struggles that they are putting their lives on the line for.
Well, John, we really appreciate the work that you and your crew of warriors are putting together on a regular basis, and it's certainly been a pleasure having you on the show and on our station, just to keep us up to date on these very important movements and struggles worldwide. All the best to you and to IEC.
No, it won't go well. Thank you very much.
We've been speaking with John Chertow. He is editor-in-chief of Intercontinental Cry. If you wish to support his work, please visit the site intercontinentalcry.org and click support on the menu bar. Patricia Elliott is associate professor with the University of Regina's School of Journalism. She's also one of the faculty evaluators with Project Censored. She joins us again to talk about some of the underreported stories out of Canada. Professor Elliott, welcome.
Thanks very much. I'm glad to be here.
So I thought we should lead our conversation with the story of Indigenous people invoke treaty rights over hydropower license.
Right.
That's in your home province of Saskatchewan. Could you provide some more details about that?
This is a story that student Caitlin Taylor was looking into. Basically, we had a hydro station here. The license came up for renewal after 50 years. It was time to renew again. There had been a lot of downstream issues for northern Indigenous communities, particularly around the Saskatchewan River Delta, related in part to the hydro station. But when Caitlin looked for news articles about this license coming up for renewal, she couldn't find anything. She only knew about it through conversations with people from up north. And so this is why she kind of keyed in on that as an underreported story.
Interesting. And is this the kind of story that, like, whenever there's issues around hydro, they might bring up other elements, but they tend to miss the Indigenous angle?
That's partly it, but in this case, they didn't even really bring up the story itself. A concern for Indigenous people in the area because they were finding that it was affecting lake levels and potentially affecting the delta as well. So there's a lot of trapping and fishing that were being impacted by the dams on the Saskatchewan River. I guess that message just wasn't getting out to the wider Saskatchewan community. It's also physically isolated from where the major news outlets are, so that could be part of it. And basically, newsrooms just don't have the people on the ground. They don't have the reporters able to travel. So that was a story that really went under the radar that probably shouldn't have.
There's another Saskatchewan-centric story that your students brought forward. It delves into depressed social indicators in yes. Saskatchewan that are easily available through Statistics Canada, but no major news networks seem to have connected the dots and explored what's at the root of those indicators. So what is independent media reporting revealed about that situation?
Well, in this case, we often hear, like in the mainstream media, if a study comes out or a report from StatsCan, we'll hear, you know, very sporadically about, you know, a crime rate or maybe something to do with HIV. But what Brenna Engel found was that no one was really connecting the dots. And in fact, you know, there were a few alternative media reports that did so, but mainly she was just looking at the Statistics Canada reports that they issued. So Saskatchewan has had this history of the past decade of really being promoted as the place to be, where there's a lot of economic development, things have been going great. I know that story's changing this year, but we've been fed this story that there's a tremendous amount of wealth and prosperity in the province. Yet at the same time, the social indicators are really depressed compared to other parts of Canada. in terms of things like everything from drunk driving to domestic abuse. University tuition fees are the highest here. You know, we've got the lowest number of bilingual speakers, highest level of HIV. So what Brenna wondered was, why isn't this a story? Not just a story about, for example, drug use, but a story about all of these things together. Why is Saskatchewan seeming to lag in these areas?
Interesting. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you have a sort of a general take on the kinds of stories in Canada that are getting routinely underreported or outright distorted.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, obviously, Indigenous stories are not covered as well as they should be. There have been improvements, but if you go to, if you live in a small town, your small town paper may not be covering what's the news from the First Nation that's right next door to this small town, for example. So there's a lot of continuing blind spots out there. The unfounded story from the Globe and Mail was a great example of a thing that everybody knew about. I mean, if you're female in Canada, you know that reports of sexual assault get dismissed. I mean, you just know that from experience and from your friends' experiences. That is something that the Globe and Mail went after in a very systematic way and did a great job. But we would have seen that in alternative media long before the Globe and Mail got a hold of it. We've heard, you know, people speaking on it in forums like community radio, the alternative press, but it's taken a little longer. The value of mainstream media coming on board is, in that case, they were able to throw a whole lot of resources at that story.
Interesting. Yeah. Are we seeing any kind of a trend of, you know, maybe community radio giving, you know, kind of, I don't know, tipping off mainstream media, or are they kind of like two solitudes?
In some ways, they're two solitudes to a point, and eventually that sort of hidden transcript coming out of community media makes its way into mainstream consciousness, but a lot of key issues will show up first on community radio. They will show up first in alternative newspapers or in community access television even. And that's the great thing about alternative media. The whole point of the Project Censored exercise for my students is to get them looking at those sources, because that's where you see it first. I mean, even something like, oh, like recycling was considered a radical concept even 20 years ago, and would only be appearing in, you know, real serious discussion on it in environmental magazines, sort of alternative green magazines. Now that's considered a mainstream topic, right? I know from my own experience working with a women's magazine back in the 80s, the story of missing and murdered Indigenous women was well known in women's communities. It was well known in the alternative press, and was being covered to the extent that people could do so. It took a couple of decades for it to break through.
And
it's really important to pay attention to alt media.
Yeah, I think that does speak to the issue of power dynamics, and like who has power and then who's in a position to say, oh, that doesn't really matter, or whatever. So I'm wondering then if you could describe the current media landscape in Canada and developments, say, in the last couple of years that might be contributing to this suppression or neglect of certain sorts of stories.
Well, probably one of the biggest developments is under the Harper government, support for media development in Canada completely had the pin pulled out, and the Trudeau government has not replaced that pin. So even, like, for example, the magazine landscape is really populated by non-profit magazines, are like probably one of the biggest contributors to magazine journalism in Canada. They lost a lot of their government support. So nonprofit media has been really, really struggling. And that's at a loss to our media landscape. people tend to focus on, the mainstream market-based for-profit businesses. But we've got in Canada a huge and very important sector of nonprofit and co-op media that most people don't realize the level of the cuts that were leveled against that sector. We're aware of the cuts to CBC during that period because CBC is like one thing and it's very present and there's friends of Canadian broadcasting to sound the alarm. But when it comes to nonprofit media, it's like a lot of little cuts to little media outlets. That's a problem because as we're just talking about, it's these smaller, more community-connected outlets that are really the leading edge of stories that matter to Canadians.
Yeah, you were talking earlier about the lack of proximity of newsrooms to the stories, especially those affecting rural peoples and people in indigenous communities. Are we seeing trends in terms of that evaporation of some of these local newsrooms and the impacts they're having?
Yeah, there has been a big decline over the last decade in local newspapers and local independent television stations in Canada. The Canadian government, even now, is just sitting back and watching that whole local news landscape implode and doing nothing. Quebec has moved in with some funding assistance to shore up some of its local news outlets. Elsewhere in Canada, there hasn't been any response from Ottawa, and that's hugely irresponsible. Because media development is important in Canada. Media, and especially local news, is part of the infrastructure of democracy. It's infrastructure like roads and rail lines. We need local news. We need journalists. And Canada used to provide a pretty healthy level of media development assistance, as other countries do around the world. But those programs, as I mentioned, were mostly canceled. So we've seen, I know in Manitoba, there have been newspaper closures there. I think this year, Grandview lost at the Exponent, which is a 117-year-old paper. In Saskatchewan, we lost the Moose Jaw Times Herald, which was, again, more than 100 years old, had served the Moose Jaw community as a daily paper, now gone with no replacement. And that's a big problem facing Canadians.
We've been speaking with Patricia Elliott, associate professor with the University of Regina's School of Journalism and one of the faculty evaluators with Project Censored. She joined us from the University of Regina. Before we go, we'd like to remind listeners that Global Research founder and editor Professor Michel Chosadovsky will be visiting two Canadian cities this month to speak to public audiences about the Korean crisis and the threat of a nuclear war emerging out of it. He speaks in Winnipeg January 15th from 2:30 to 4 at the University of Manitoba's University College in room 244, before speaking that same evening at 7 p.m. at the University of Winnipeg's Eckhart Gramaté Hall. On Tuesday, January 16th, the same day U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson meets in Vancouver with Canadian Foreign Minister Chrystia Freeland to discuss the Korean crisis, Professor Chosadovsky will speak in the city at the Vancouver Public Library at 350 West Georgia Street at 7 p.m. Please check the website globalresearch.ca for complete details. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs weekly on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email us at globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.